Hi, I'm Keith.
Hi, this is Ragini.
And welcome to More Than Masala, a podcast where a chef and a culinary researcher talk about spices from the Indian subcontinent, from how to use them to sometimes the dark history behind their origins. Every episode, Ragini and I do a deep dive into one spice and talk about the history as well as how to use the spice. Ragini, it feels like it's been 100 years. We were just catching up right before we hit the record button, and a lot's happened in both of our worlds. How are you doing?
A lot has happened. I'm doing good. We've had a lot of change since we were last doing a podcast, which was on your not even your kitchen counter anymore, like your once was kitchen counter, which seems like a year ago.
It does. It feels like it's been at least a year, but I bought a house with my girlfriend and I, which we're stoked. We turned it into a home. So that's good. It feels like we're getting situated. You know, like the hardest part of moving is when you're like, especially spices, like you're trying to get everything organized, and you're going through this now because you are now back in India, right?
I am. Yes. I just moved to India, and that's exactly right. I was just actually yesterday, I was thinking, I don't want to move my spices out of Ziploc bags until I have the perfect containers for them. So if anyone has recommendations on really nice spice containers, then hit me up.
Oh man, we're going to talk after that. I didn't know, but this is exactly what I did. So yeah, man, it's good to catch up. Let's talk mustard today. I feel like it's probably an important conversation, seeing that it's the topic for today. More importantly, I think it's one of the spices to me that I have learned so much from by studying food from the subcontinent. So I'm excited to talk about it today. Are you ready?
Sure am. Let's get going. Mustard is so fundamental to so much food from the subcontinent, but also to the food from pretty much everywhere outside of the Americas traditionally. And so I'm really excited to get into it. It's one of the few foods I feel like didn't come from the New World. I feel like so many other things that we know and love today, we're like, oh, where did this come from? It came from Central America, South America. Oh, okay, where did this come from? You know. But yeah. I think in mustard, we finally find something that has some root in this part of the world, from Egypt through India all the way up to China. So should we dig in?
I'm so ready. Let's do this thing.
All right, so let's kick it off with a little bit of history about mustard. There's so many different types of mustard. I mean, there are some that are more common than others, and we'll get into that. But there's actually over 40 different varieties of mustard. And the four most common are the ones that we use around the world today, and some are more popular in some parts of the world and others in other parts. But in India, they were said to have been discovered at the Indus Valley site of Chandhudaro. And then there is some mustard that was also discovered in China, but also the oldest mustard is said to have been kind of around where Egypt is today. And, you know, the Greeks and Romans used mustard, the Egyptians used mustard, the Indians used mustard, the Chinese used mustard. So it's something that's definitely made its way around the world and kind of made its mark wherever it's gone. And this, I'm just talking all about more ancient history, and we'll come to more modern history and kind of an oxymoron, modern history. We'll come to more contemporary history in a bit. So like I was saying, multiple species of mustard. Most of the 40 species are members of the Brassicas or Sinapis genera. And the plant is both closely related to broccoli and cabbage. And hopefully as soon as I say that, you can immediately start to draw flavor parallels of kind of the pungent flavors of mustard and broccoli and cabbage, even if it's not something that you'd previously connected. So the seeds of mustard first appear at the archaeological records in China, dated about 6,800 years ago. And before it became, you know, either a condiment in the West or a spice in other parts of the world, the seeds were harvested and the plant was used both as a spice, but also as a medicine. And so in a lot of ancient Chinese, Indian, and Sumerian texts from around 2000 BCE, mention mustard in the context of its medicinal properties. And You know, we talked about turmeric on not our last episode, but last episode. And that's also very strongly related to its, or very strongly known for its medicinal properties. And I think, you know, when we've talked about several spices, it at some point medicine comes up. And so more and more as we dig through this, one of the things that's become really clear to me is that there is just so much knowledge around the properties of spices, which a lot of people hold in their homes intuitively today because it's been passed down. And I just wanted to make a really quick point about culture here. So speaking specifically about the subcontinent, most of culture that's been passed down has been passed down orally. Very little has been written down in the context of how much there is. So the way that culture is passed down time and again, and science is therefore passed down in this way, is you can't explain to every single person that, hey, you know, this is for this, and here's the seven different things this is good for, so on and so forth. What you can do is culturally say, at this time, this is what we eat. At this time, that is what we eat. And kind of bring it into ritual rather than into science, because ritual is frankly easier for people to remember than science is. So it's very interesting as you start to dig through how cultures emerge, how it's used often as a tool to pass on what is essentially scientific information, you know, like the idea, like I can't tell you why I know that mangoes create heat in your body, for example, but I know that intuitively, right? Someone has told me that my whole life. So I know that in certain weather, I have to be careful about how many mangoes are eaten, or in order to remove the heat from mango, I need to soak it in some water because that's better for my body. But I couldn't necessarily, unless I went out to look for why, I couldn't necessarily tell you why. I just, you know it is the way it is. And actually, I'm forgetting who wrote this paper, but I will look it up. There's a very interesting theory that says that, you know, culture developed at a certain pace, passing down information from generation to generation, which included science. At some point, religion came into it. At some, you know, it started with how do we stay alive, which is what I'm sort of calling science. It's not modern science in the same way we think of that today, but it started with these tips and tricks to stay alive and the foods that we can use to aid that. And then it went on to incorporating whatever religion was, you know, in that land. It went on to all of the other traditions and so on. And it sort of layered, and one thing builds up upon another. But a recent paper theorizes that essentially that has been, most significantly challenged by technology. So culture has changed at a faster rate in the last 25 to 40 years than it did in the hundreds, in the centuries before that. And the reason for that is that technology has given people the ability to ask the question, why, right? And so technology has opened up the world in a way that it was never opened up before. And in so doing has provided the greatest mirror or the greatest challenge to what were perhaps quote unquote traditional cultures before that. So anyway, that's a huge aside, but I think it's so interesting how all of this information that we talk about on this podcast, so many people have in their heads, unbeknownst even to them, you know, they just operate by the principles of this information.
And that's amazing, because it's funny, like as a Westerner, I certainly didn't know that mangoes like create heat in your body. You think of a mango being the sweet thing. And I think I associate sweets with like a cooling effect, right? So it's so cool to hear it like from that other perspective. I've got a weird fact. You ready for this one? I'm so excited for this one. this is us nerding out. So you talked about mustard being in the brassica family. Well, you're right. Absolutely. Another thing in the brassica family that isn't used in India is the Brussels sprout. And I learned that there's not even a Hindi word for Brussels sprout, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it is very cool to buy Brussels sprouts in India. They usually come in a bag and cost you an arm and a leg for about 100 grams. So I can definitely testify to that as someone who loves Brussels sprouts and lives in India now.
And it's funny because I think from a climate perspective, obviously a lot of that makes sense. But as you get into some of the cooler climates, you know, up in the mountain ranges and things like that, you'd think that there might be a little opportunity there, but really great part of the brassica family as well. So just that was my little nerdy fact.
Oh, I love Brussels sprouts. And you're coming up to Thanksgiving when it's perfectly acceptable to eat like a bucket full of
I will send you, and it's funny because most
them.
people, like in the West, when we grow up eating, and I'm totally tangenting right now. When we grow up eating them, it's this aversion to them because a lot of people don't know how to cook them. They'll like boil them and it's disgusting. You have to roast them really hard and they get this caramelizing effect. Just like if you were to, like roast gobi hard, you get that beautiful caramelization.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I
Boiled
digress.
vegetables in general, I think, is a blasphemy. But, who am I to say? But let's come back to a couple of the common varieties of mustard. So there's four varieties that are now most common, and I'll say both the English name as well as what they're. I don't know if they're all necessarily. They are Hindi, but I think they also go into other languages in. On the subcontinent as well with similar names. So four varieties. The first is the black mustard, which is rai, which is obviously used a lot in tadka and especially in the southern part of the country. The second is the brown sarson. The third is the yellow sarson, which is maybe the white mustard. And then the last is the reddish brown, so the darker red brown toria. And Indian mustard oil is usually a combination of all four seeds. And then rapeseed oil is a mixture of the toria and the sarson, so the reddish brown and the brown sarson, so or the yellow sarson, pardon me. So it's I actually when I was looking into this, I had always assumed that mustard oil was made of one type of mustard seed. So I didn't realize that the commonly accepted oil was actually a composite of four of the four most common types of mustard seed that are on the subcontinent.
I just learned that one too. That's incredible.
Yeah, I thought it was really super interesting as well. And I mean, mustard oil is something that obviously is very pungent and has a very, very distinct flavor. In Punjab, or at least in my family, we actually make a lot of we make a lot of vegetables and meat in mustard oil, not so much dal, but definitely vegetables and meats are largely cooked in mustard oil. So very, very common up in the north. And then obviously in Kashmir, a lot of usage of the mustard and all the way down into the central and east part of India, into Bengal and Odia, where they use it quite differently. And one very interesting difference in the usage is that in Punjab, as far as at least as far as I know, and I could be wrong on this, is that we very rarely use mustard oil raw. Whereas if you get to Bihar and Bengal, there's very often the pouring of raw mustard oil onto a dish or just about cooking it, very lightly, using it more as a finishing oil than as a cooking oil, which is just not something we do. So if you think about the choka, it's sort of broiled tomato or eggplant or whatever vegetable you're using, and then you finish it with mustard oil, which is not something you do in the north, which creates obviously an entirely different flavor profile because mustard oil uncooked is very different, and also why it's then important to use like a cold pressed oil as opposed to a commercial oil, because that's when you start to get into some of the more problematic parts of mustard oil consumption. And actually for a while in both Canada and the US, mustard oil was banned. And I think there's still, I don't know if you know more about this, I need to look it up, but there's still some rules and regulations, higher rules and regulations around, or more stringent rules and regulations around what kind of mustard oil can be sold and or not sold.
Yeah, so a lot of places in the West, the FDA and stuff, were really considering mustard oil to be carcinogenic in some of its properties. And so for consumption, a lot of the labeling had to switch to this is not for consumption, even though it was for consumption. It was specifically a property of it, and it's escaping me off the top of my head that they were really concerned of for studies. But if you think about it, just listening to what you said about the history of mustard oil, this is something that's been consumed for thousands upon thousands of years. So it's interesting to see the data kind of take this divergence at that point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's again going back to what we were talking about a minute ago in terms of, and we talked about this with turmeric as well. It's about knowing how to use a certain thing. Like most foods could be just as good as they are bad, just as safe as they are dangerous, you know, so on and so forth. Some foods obviously more than others, but all food sits kind of on that spectrum of use me right and I will, you know, I will be good to you, and kind of, you know, don't. And I think turmeric, we talked about the turmeric, like people taking pills of turmeric that are just running through their body and not actually giving them the benefit they think they're getting. And it comes with that knowledge of like, okay, how do I use this spice? You know, how do I use this oil? What do I need to see or what do I need to avoid in order to do that? And so knowing that, you know, mustard has, I mean, olive oil is a great example, right? A low smoking point. You heat it up too much, at some point it's just going to become poisonous and yep. be really bad for you. So I think that's maybe a part of it. So yes, scientifically, you may find certain things, but I think the benefits of mustard far outweigh that if you know how to use the oil. But appreciate that not everyone does, and so the warnings are probably necessary. Just jumping back on the history bandwagon for one second, that we talked about it going all the way back to ancient Egypt and China and so on, but the prepared version of mustard was actually, where do you think this happened first? Prepared version of mustard.
Prepared? I'm going to say China. It has to be, right?
Da, 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 da. In fact, it was not. So in China, they largely eat the leaves of mustard. So the mustard greens, and if you like go to any Chinese grocery store, you'll see the pickled mustard greens, which I highly recommend. They're delicious. But the mustard greens are super, super popular. But the first prepared version of it was a Roman invention. And so the ancient Romans, they used to grind mustard seeds and use them to make a paste, which is similar to kind of the mustard that we use today. And then they also used to make a wine out of the mustard seeds.
Ah, verju. Uh-huh. Yeah. I did read about that. So I've been deep diving into a lot of food from Bengal. And interesting, when you start to think about mustard, yeah, that's right. I learned that you take the paste and you mix it with the juice of unripened grapes and you get verju, right?
Exactly. And so the Greeks and the Romans would blend ground up mustard seeds with unfermented grape juice at first, or a must. And so if you think of the word mustik in Arabic and so on. Anyway, it starts, I don't know if it starts from here, but there's definitely some connection there. And they would mix that to make a smooth mixture. And the first version of this, they say, wasn't necessarily food. It was more likely for its medicinal properties because of all the things we've just talked about.
Yeah, I can't imagine how acidic that would be, right?
Right.
I hope you have something. Yeah, you need something super fatty to balance that acid.
Yeah, seriously. So what else do we have? I think that's a lot of the history, and we've talked about where it comes down to. I mean, you see a lot of if we look at history and religion kind of together, because you know, one is essentially an expression of the other, but you see a lot of mention of mustard, and especially in Bengal. So any food that's cooked with mustard is said to be tamasic. And so Lord Shiva, associated often with mustard, because he's not a lord associated with the sattvic food culture that we're seeing a lot of today necessarily. And religiously, in mustard is seen to be a purifier across actually a number of religions, but varied usage for each seed during the rituals in Hinduism specifically. And so there's a lot of imagery around mustard. There's a lot of usage around mustard. And then the seed was also said to be useful for women postpartum, with mustard used in her bath. So again, this all comes back to that knowledge that's kind of passed down, just sort of almost unknowingly. And it was obviously believed to have had very strong properties, because the word for mustard actually in the Atharvaveda is abhaya, which translates to fear inspiring, which is interesting. Yeah,
that's and then the fact.
You see a seed and you think of it as inspiring fear, it obviously can do a lot. And then actually, even in Christianity, you see the mustard seed referenced in the book of Luke in the Bible, which, you were probably better equipped to tell us more about this.
For sure. So I've got a fun fact as we lead into that. I've been excited to share this one with you, but it's actually reported that around 1000 AD, Pope John the 12th loved mustard so much that he actually created a Vatican position for a mustard maker. So that, to me, that's crazy. Loving it so much that you're like, I need an official mustard maker to the Pope.
It's one of those like brilliant facts about someone who's in a position of power who just uses it for the most silly thing possible, seemingly silly thing possible.
So I won't defend religion all the time, but I will say at least he used his power for something that wouldn't cause great harm. In this case, in this one specific case.
So question on that just struck me, is that because there was a position for a mustard maker, is that one of the reasons for the number of varieties of prepared mustard paste that we see? Because there were people like tasked with doing that, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, it's the invention of so many different styles at that point. And when you have a mustard maker who's specifically for the Pope, you have those experiments, you have those things that you can do, which it really elevated the condiment to a whole different level.
So interesting. And what's also super interesting about the way mustard, and we're going to get into the more Western usage of mustard in a second, but what's also super interesting is how different it can be how differently it can flavor dishes or taste itself based on the seed, obviously, but then also what you do with the seed, it changes the flavor entirely. So the darker the mustard seed, so the rai, the hotter and more flavorful it tends to be. And then and the heat of mustard seeds is called by an enzyme, which the name of which I'm totally going to butcher, but it's caused by an enzyme called myrosinase, mm-hmm. which can then be neutralized with heat, which is why the black mustard or the rye we often see used with high heat in order to extract the flavor, but reduce some of the heat of the seed itself. And so black mustard is considered to be extremely hot compared with other varieties. But then when it's toasted or fried, it actually becomes a little sweeter or a little nuttier. And so that's why I think we largely see it used in the subcontinent as in a tarka. You see rye in a tarka most often. It's always used with a lot of fat. And it's either bloomed in oil or ghee, or then it's crushed to a paste and used kind of as a marinade for meat. So always kind of around a lot of fat. And in Ayurveda, mustard, we're just talking about mango being hot, but in Ayurveda, mustard also, mustard seeds are decidedly hot and create heat in the body. And externally, they're used, a paste is made of mustard seed to cure abscesses, itches, or even rheumatism. And internally, it plays a strong role in balancing the three doshas. So a little bit of mustard to sort of balance your body out generally. And then obviously, if you are familiar with Ayurvedic massage, mustard oil is very good for the skin, hair, joints, and organs. So it's used very, very heavily in that. And I just said that the name for mustard is fear-inspiring, which is abhaya. And then if you think about the massage in Ayurveda, it's called abhyangam, which is with mustard oil. So that massage is meant to be very, very powerful, hot mustard oil. If you haven't had one in your life, I highly recommend you find someone who can give you an abhyanga massage or figure out how to do it yourself and do it. They are incredibly relaxing. That's kind of, I don't know. Is there anything else we want to say about like religion or the flavor or all of these things that we've gone on little tangential offshoots on before we move into kind of like, well, what do we do with mustard today everywhere else?
I feel like there's probably a lot we could geek out on from like, you know, Egyptians and flavoring their food with mustard, the mustard seeds being found in the tomb of Tutankhamun and things like that. But I digress. I think everyone wants to know about usage and cultivation. What do you think?
Sounds good. So where is mustard grown? How does it grow? Who grows it? How long does it take? Tell us everything.
Oh, look at this role reversal. All right. So, you know, mustard's cool because mustard seeds actually take about 8 to 10 days to germinate, which is really, really small when you think about it. Mm-hmm. Here's a good one, Ragini. This is a tough one. Can you think of another crop that takes about 8 to 10 days to germinate and is very iconic on the subcontinent. Begins with an M.
Begins with an M.
M as in man. Dun, dun, dun. Moments.
Mace?
No. Oh, that's a good one. Meti.
Oh, really?
Yeah, fenugreek actually.
Oh, threw me off because I obviously was not thinking it. Excuse.
I have this recorded that Ragini didn't know something because, listen, she knows a lot, like so much more than me. So
she also doesn't know a lot. Very much.
So Meti actually germinates very quickly as well, but mustard seed specifically is about 8 to 10 days. And I know you know this one. What is the world's, who grows actually the most mustard seed in the entire world?
This I do know, and it's Canada.
Yes, oh Canada. They grow Canada. They actually grow about 28% of the world's crop, followed by Nepal and Myanmar. They actually hold the title for the leading exporter, obviously, of mustard seed, with the top importer being the United States. Mustard has really evolved in the West, I think, a lot. And we've certainly seen it a lot, you know, even in my lifetime. I feel like for me growing up in the West, you think of French's, that yellow mustard, which we'll get into in a minute, but that's your exposure to mustard. And then as you graduate, you learn what Dijon is, you know, and you feel sophisticated. But when I started learning about food from the subcontinent and the usage of mustard seed, it completely changed my thought process on mustard, which is cool. In Pakistan, rapeseed mustard is the second most important source of oil after cotton, actually. So cotton oil is the second. So much so that in Pakistan, it's actually cultivated over an area of 307,000 hectares with an annual production of 233 tons. And it contributes to about 17% of the gross production of edible oil in the entire country, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
When we take the nutrient value of mustard, this is where I think we get a lot, and we start to understand a little bit more about what you were speaking about earlier when it comes to kind of the Ayurvedic approach, the health approach. So mustard seeds are actually really rich in sources of oil and protein. So the mustard seed oil has about 46 to 48% oil. The whole seed meal is about 43.6% protein, which is cool when you look at the breakdown of it. Yeah, it's like that statistic that's blew my mind.
Extraordinarily high. Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't think from a perspective of protein, but it's pretty great. As we know, white mustard seeds are typically larger, less pungent, and have a milder flavor. This is why they were adopted very much so in the West. In the West, people think ketchup is spicy oftentimes. So when you introduce mustard, the pungency is something that, you know, needed to be balanced, as opposed to the brown mustard seed. And you look at, for me, I always say brown mustard seeds are the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde of mustards, because they start so pungent, but the minute they start to be fried, they start to release this nuttiness and this beautiful flavor, and the pungency goes away. So it's interesting. Yeah. Black mustard seeds, native to the Middle East, pungent in taste, obviously nutty after roasting. You think a lot when it comes to Bengal, their use of black mustard seed. And the most important mixture, I would think, from a Bengali perspective, Ragini, panch.
Oh, punch corn.
Yeah, of course. Oh man, I'm putting her on the spot. Now I'm getting nervous. yes, panch puran, you think of black mustard seed usage in that. And then obviously in South India, the use in sambar powder. Super good there.
And I think also just the every like tadka, right? Like you think of the mustard curry leaf, red chili combination and hing, and that's kind of your like, I don't know. It's not a holy trinity because it's four. Holy trinity.
What would after be trinity? I have to think of the word that would be after that. Well, we'll go with it. Anyway, yeah. Quadrinity?
Quadrinity.
We're such nerds.
Please forgive us and keep listening.
Yeah. Rate us 5 stars. Talking about yellow mustard from a Western perspective, I want to bring it back to that for a minute. So the typical yellow mustard condiment that you get was actually developed in Rochester, New York in 1904. And it's basically this mixture of grinding the seeds with water, vinegar, and sometimes some other liquids as well. And it creates this yellow condiment known as prepared mustard. And that's only in 1904 in Rochester, New York, which is crazy.
Not very far from where you are.
No, it's not too far at all. Rochester's also really cool. So to think that they developed what we know as, you know, the typical mustard is awesome. Other uses of mustard, we obviously look at oil, we look at powder. Whenever I make mac and cheese, one of the recipes that always calls for is mustard powder. And we use mustard powder in mac and cheese specifically for this kind of acidic component to it that helps balance and bring in some life to the rest of the dish. There's only a little bit that's used. It also is used for a coloring agent, which a lot of people don't know about. Which is cool. Obviously the leaves, when you look at mustard, you can literally go from leaf to root from its usage, which is really cool with it. Like we should with garlic and all of these other things as well. As we start to talk about other varieties of mustard, like an English mustard, that's when you're taking yellow and brown and you're basically blending them down to a very smooth and you get that brown, which gives that hotness to it. We get Dijon mustard. Do you know why we get the word Dijon?
Dun, 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 dun. I do not.
Because it's the region of France where it was made. Yeah.
I said that and then I was like, actually, I do know that. I was like, I need to redeem myself in this.
You're actually doing great. So it's that tangy name for the region of France, made from brown seeds with wine and our friend Verjus. So we kind of come full circle here as you start to see, you know, that bring its way back in. When we look at German mustards, we look at a mixture of seeds, including like black. We look at vinegar, oil, herbs, and sometimes sweeteners as well. And German mustard.
Pungent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We can also have a lot of coarseness that's brought into German mustards. And German mustards are definitely in their own category and they're absolutely delicious. And then finally, the standard yellow mustard that we talked about always has some turmeric in it and 24% mustard powder, which is a really interesting fact on that.
That's super interesting.
Yeah,
so 24% mustard powder and then turmeric, presumably some sort of oil or fat to bind it.
Yep. Typically, it's some liquids, water and vinegar, and those get mixed all together, blended till very smooth, and you get that classic yellow mustard that if you're in the West, you know what French's is. You know, it's that classic thing that you grow up with a hot dog, you know.
It's the perfect condiment for French fries. And if anyone wants to fight me on this, I'm ready, but like don't come at me with like ketchup or mayo. It's yellow mustard with fries.
And it makes sense too, because like when you think of something like a French fry, you have this fatty, starchy thing. And in a culinary world, what always offsets fat and starch and helps balance it? Acidity.
Acid.
There you go. See, Ragini, like, you know, she posts these things like she's not a chef, but I'm telling you, she's more chef than most chefs out there. She's awesome.
Learn from the best.
So yeah, those are some of the uses of mustard. And obviously the list can go on and on and on, especially as we start to bring in the subcontinent. And man, mustard, what an unsung hero.
I have an interesting aside that you probably know of, but that made American mustard, which is already this incredibly iconic condiment and obviously most iconic on, you know, you think of that like squiggly line of mustard on a hot dog, right? Like that's kind of the image that like you've seen time and again. And actually there's a super interesting example of culinary diplomacy that is sort of centered on this sort of icon of yellow mustard, if you will, along with the hot dog. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I think I do. I think I know where this is going. Is this about a war?
It's about a war.
Yes.
So when UK realized that they were going to be fighting World War II, and they realized that they didn't really have a choice in the way that, you know, things were going with Germany, and they knew things were advancing, and they were losing a lot of the empire, so they were generally a weaker power than they had been, you know, at the beginning of World War I, and also due to World War I, still recovering from the effects of that war. And they realized that in order for them to go to war successfully, they would need the support of the United States. The United States, however, after World War I, you have Herbert Hoover come in, they go into splendid isolation, and very much the tone in the United States is that we separated from, you know, from England for a reason, and we don't want to keep being drawn into all of your wars. And that was very much the popular feeling. And so Roosevelt realized that I'm not actually going to have the support of the American people to go to war and to join forces with, you know, with Churchill and King George. And so how do we do this? How do we sort of start to change the impression? Because one of the big issues was that people obviously saw the monarchy as very problematic. They despised the class system of the UK and where it placed the common person. And if you think about hot dogs and mustard, those are very much the foods of common people. You know, you think about the iconic New York hot dog, you think about how both of those products, the hot dog itself as well as the mustard, had become these sort of mass produced, very, very affordable foods for people, and it came to really represent the common working person, right, in the United States, and not something that you would associate with anyone who had any, you know, drop of royal blood in them. And so what they decided to do was they decided to do this sort of massive PR exercise where King George and his wife came over to the US, and the Roosevelts hosted them at their Hyde Park cottage, which obviously is not much of a cottage, more of a mansion, hosted them at Hyde Park, where they had a tea party. And what they served at the tea party was, the line was, Eleanor Roosevelt throws picnic. And that was sort of the headline. And then it was actually made into a children's book as well. And if you Google it, you'll see that on the very front cover is essentially a hot dog with this squeeze of mustard, you know, this iconic squeeze of mustard down the front. And they use that to show people that, hey, look, they're just like us. Like they're eating these very processed hot dogs and mustard the same way we do. And they don't have, you know, they're not sort of being all uppity about it. They're enjoying it the same way we would. And now I'm not gonna hang my hat on to say that, you know, that's what swung popular opinion, but it definitely played a part. And so, you know, throw a little bit of culinary diplomacy into our conversation. So when we're talking about spices, we're talking medicine, we're talking taste, we're talking science, we're talking diplomacy. We're just covering the whole gamut here.
That's so good. I love that story so much. I think if we hearken back all the way to episode one, you said spices are the quiet heroes of history. And I think time and time again, this is what it's proving. And mustard, again, quiet hero of history.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you guys so much for being a part of episode seven. We're seven in, and 700 more to go, right?
Absolutely.
As always, please rate, subscribe, do all those fun things that you kids do nowadays, and share this with one of your friends, family members, or even enemies, because everyone benefits from spices, even the worst of us. Right, Raghini?
Absolutely. And it's been a little while since we put our last episode out. So we'd love to even hear from you guys. We'd love when people write into us and tell us what they think. I think the day after an episode goes out, I just love hearing people's reactions to it, because this is otherwise a very quiet space. It's just Keith and I and our mics. So tell us what you think. Tell us if you have any questions. Tell us if, you know, there is something you'd like to see us do on the podcast in terms of spices. Yeah, talk to us.
Thank you guys so much. We're going to be back with episode 8, and we will give you guys a little sneak preview of what that's going to be. I've got a fun thing for our picture on mustard, because we haven't done a picture in a little bit. And so since I've been studying a lot of Bengali food, I just made some kasundi. So I would love to share that with you guys. You can find that on my page and Ragini's page. Please follow and all that stuff. And we will see you guys soon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for being here. See you soon.